Then, that what year was that first one then that you went to, do you remember?
No, I don't remember. It was in the 40s somewhere. And at that time, I think the first one, I still didn't have my book ready. But by another year, I had the book ready, and I had 200 copies there, all autographed. And the word had spread. That first class was a howling success. They were crazy for this teaching, which I felt surely they must be. And it was plain and simple and easy to get hold of and practical. So the next year, I've forgotten where they went the next year, but in the end, I think I did seven or eight annual meetings of the General Federation. I was paid my expenses, that's all the money I got out of it, except they let me sell my book.
Oh, I see.
And I sold my autographed copy, and that really put the book on the map. Harper's did a very bad job selling it. Naturally, they didn't have a golden opportunity like this, like I had. And I began getting women in those classes who were presidents of state federations, like, for instance, a woman from Pennsylvania had 285,000 club women in the state of Pennsylvania. And so she came to all my classes. But then I had a sort of shock of disappointment because I think the third year that she turned up, she had my book there, my autographed book, and she said, "You see this book, Mrs. Butler?" She said, "You know, I never saw anything in my life so helpful. And it's right on my bedside table, right with my Bible. And every day when I go out," and she had to tour that state of Pennsylvania and speak to every club through her administration, "before I go out, I open that book again and review the things that I must remember to do. I never saw a book like it." And I said, to which I said, "Well, isn't that great? And do you tell all the women about it?" And she said, "No, I never thought of that." I nearly fainted right there, because what she did, of course, was to get people to think she was just a natural-born speaker, that this had come to her naturally, and she could have launched my book forever in that state and got all the women to get training, which they all needed. I was just horrified in a way that her vision of public service didn't go that far. But you just have to remember that the General Federation of Women's Clubs is made up of women out of their homes for the first time. They've been most of their lives working right in their homes. This is where they begin to get into public life. They begin to get trained as leaders. And the idea of spreading that training and helping the others to become leaders, they just hadn't gone that far. But it would have saved my book if they'd done that. I never found but three states that did anything to advertise my book. And those states had me come there to their states and do a series of speech lessons all over the state, and there I could sell the book and get the state to know about it. Three of the states had me do that.
So the states would invite you then to come.
Yeah, the states would then invite me to come there and do a series of speech workshops in several cities. Several cities. I went to Ohio, I remember. I went to Wyoming and several other states doing that. And gradually, the temper and the skill of public speaking began to develop in that organization. But the headquarters would never lift a finger to push the book. They had a rigid rule that the only book they endorsed was Robert's Rules of Order and Parliamentary Procedure. And so, of course, when Hugh had to leave Washington and I had to leave with him, the promotional work that I had done ended, and the book went out of print within a couple of years because it completely lacked the sponsorship of all those women and what they got out of it. I still, the other day even, I went swimming right here in Pomona where I had taught at Mount Sac for 6 years and used the book there. And there was a woman in the swimming pool saying, "Why, Mrs. Butler, there I am. What did I enjoy that course in public speaking? And it's made my career a success." I've met that all wherever I go, so that it has been a frustrating experience to let that book die as a hardcover book and not be able to get it into a paperback, which I haven't been able to do yet.
Well, now, Jesse, what was your plan when you left Washington? What did you think you would do out here in California then? Did you think you would continue with giving this? What were your expectations of what you would then do?
When I would come to California? Well, this is where I had a great disappointment. In the first place, I should have known that I came out to California, of course, with a blazing career, a great, successful, amazing career. And naturally, when you leave one state and go to another, you think that automatically you're going to take your career with you, but you don't. You have to start all over again as if you'd never done anything. And California is particularly that way. They get very bored with the people who come to California with a great career, who think they're famous, who think they're talented, and they don't think so. They haven't discovered that. And then I did hope that I could get a position as a teacher in one of the colleges on the Pomona campus. They had then just one woman's college. Now they've got two there. And there was no good course in public speaking in any of the western states for women. Of course, naturally, Oregon and Washington had state universities, and they had speech courses there for the men and women. But we had Mills College here. We had the college on the Pomona campus, Scripps College, a women. And so, of course, I went to that college at once and with this career. And nobody could have been any more bored with the idea than they were. The president was a man, an exceedingly good speaker. He told me with great confidence that his girls gained platform poise through interpretive dancing, through amateur dramatics, and through making images with hand images. What do you call that? What do you call that skill of things that you make with your hand? Yes. And he said, that's the way that we teach our girls poise on a platform. So I said to him, well, Mr. President, you're a good speaker. Is that the way you learned to be such a good speaker? And he rather dodged the question. And then he said, besides, he didn't have any money to put in a speech department. And I went to quite a good many meetings where his students were, and you never heard one of them ask a question. They were utterly illiterate, frankly. They couldn't speak at all. One time, the United Nations Association decided to invite the Scripps students to come and put on a round table on international affairs or on the United Nations. And I never heard any worse performance in all my life. They had no platform poise. They didn't know how to sit on a platform. You couldn't hear what they were saying. Well, they were just complete amateurs. And the Pomona campus was satisfied with that situation. So when he said he couldn't afford it, I said, well, if we could find enough money back east to launch that class in your college, would that help? Oh, yes, that would help. How much would it take? Well, $100,000. At 5% would be $5,000 to start the department. Well, I had a lot of women that were interested in helping me start such a course on the western coast and thought they could raise that money. So when I told him that, I said, but of course, they do want me to start the class. Oh, he said, we could not guarantee that. It was his board that selected the teachers, not himself. Well, of course, I knew what would happen. He'd put on a course, a milksop teacher, water it all down so that it didn't have any teeth in it, and it would be a rotten job, so he didn't get his $100,000. So the first 10 years in California were terribly disappointing to me. But I should have known that you don't take a career from one place and pop it down in another. You have to earn it.
Did you have difficulty with some of the schools because of your age?
Well, I did with Mount SAC. I taught there 6 years, and then somehow somebody found I was 75 years old, and that ended that. I wasn't supposed to teach there after 65. And I had a tremendous success at Mount SAC. I began teaching many very important men and women in this whole area in that class. It was a shame to stop it. Just a shame.
When did you begin? Okay, so in 1950 you came out here. And during that first year that your husband went to Mexico, you wrote your autobiography then, didn't you?
Yeah.
And then did you start doing any teaching at all around?
No, I couldn't. Well, it was several years before I got started at Mount SAC. And that was a very gratifying experience. I began having very large classes and getting in people from this whole area in political work and in all kinds of things. But then when they found out my age, why, that ended. And then you know what? I was determined to do something, and here I was with this nice career going to pieces. And so I started to go to Vic Taney, you know. And well, that was along about 55 or 6. And for 3 years, I went 3 times a week to Vic Taney and completely changed the condition of my body. It's the best thing I ever did in all my life. I was flabby and soft, and I hadn't done much exercising. They had a nice pool there so one could get good swimming. And I went for 3 years, 3 times a week, and worked it to all those machinery they had there. And they were wonderful, really. And I hardened up my whole body. In fact, I don't think I'd be alive today without having done that. So you see, you don't have to sit by and fold your hands and cry. And then another thing happened was very interesting. When you've been married a long time, and we were married in 1920 and now 1950, it was 30 years. And my husband had a howling career in Washington and England, and so had I. And we both come out here, and one prima donna in a house is something, but two prima donnas in a house are impossible. And we really had a horrible time. Also, I had never cooked. I'd never kept house, you see. And we didn't have an establishment that warranted a housekeeper such as we'd had. Our children were gone. And we just had a horrible time. You know what we did? We went to Dr. Paul Papineau and got tested. And when you go to about our marriage, and this is where a great many marriages fall apart after 30 years, and your life changes, your work changes, everything just vanishes. It just flattens out. And this is where a great many people's marriages break up. We didn't want our marriage to break up, and so we went to Dr. Papineau, and you know what he does? He gives you a questionnaire of 300 questions to answer. And my husband, God bless him, is the best sport I ever saw. A lot of men say, I'm not going to do that. That's ridiculous. Why waste time doing anything as silly as that? And he was desperately in need of something to do, too. But he did do 2 or 3 things that were very exciting at that time. But anyway, the next time you got back to Dr. Papineau, he had you on a curve. And we found some astonishing things about ourselves that we hadn't known. And so we had to start our marriage all over again, this time based on actual characteristics that needed attention, but we hadn't had time to discover them or to know how to work at them. And it saved our marriage, without a doubt. It was a great experience and an invigorating experience. So that was one thing. Then my husband put on a festival of faith in Pomona, in the beautiful Bridges Hall, like the festival of faith they'd had at the United Nations in the Cowles Palace when they met there. And he was very much interested in the United Nations, so he worked 2 or 3 years on that festival of faith, and that was useful. And then we found a new religion that for 18 years we followed, and I'm not going into that because, of course, any religion is a very personal thing.
So that was in 1955 or so?
That was about 52 or 53 we found that religion. And we've been going into that, over into Glendale, twice a week for 18 years. And I think that's the greatest thing of all that came to us and has been the cause of our long married life and our long life of health and happiness and vitality. So you see, although we came to California prepared to carry on a career and couldn't carry it on, other things came up that were really more important. Those careers we'd finished anyway. We'd done everything we could with them. And we built up these other things, these other interests, with great success. And it's an interesting thing that how you can find something else to do when everything falls apart like that.
Is during this time when you had all the problems, you know, trying to get still somehow continue with your career, you finally then started teaching at Mount Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And is that the only teaching that you did of speaking once you came to California, or did you do some other teaching as well?
Well, I've had some other classes now. Let me see. Well, I've kind of forgotten where they were. I've had two classes here for the National Organization of Women. One, really. The other one fizzled out. We didn't get very many people. And let me see now. Oh, I have all. I had a class for the YWCA that was just starting and is now a very big, prosperous organization here. I had a lot of women in that. And we met in a hall in Laverne College that loaned us a hall for that class. That was a great success. I had that fairly soon after I got here.
Oh.
The YWCA class, and
so you did do a fair amount of teaching still after.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Nothing like, you see, Washington is so organized and professional, and I never got into the rhythm of those big classes that just to sort of organize themselves. And I hadn't told about Mrs. William Fulbright, who's, you know, Fulbright, who he was, after Mrs. Roosevelt had done it 3 years, and after that Mrs. Fulbright came and opened up my classes. And I had Pearl Meston, marvelous panel of speakers, but you see, that was easy to do. Get up a class out here, and women are busy, and they aren't very pressed, and aren't in a hurry, and it's been awful hard to get them going. But that YWCA class was a great success.
So in effect then, coming to California began another whole new
That's
era
right.
of your
mm-hmm.
life, where you were really not as involved with that career.
That's right. And it was a religion
uh-huh.
and the health career.
Uh-huh.
Wasn't that amazing to take 3 years? I went three times a week to take that Victani, and I hardened up my body. I was that's why I'm still alive, that's all. I was all soft and flabby. And I'd worked so hard there in Washington, and then every summer Hugh and I went out to Pudding Stone Dam swimming every day. And we, both of us, really, we built up our whole bodies. And then we had some terrible problems with our daughter. She had two bad marriages and her little children, and we did an awful lot of babysitting. But it's the same kind of thing happens with her. There's no story in it, you see. We had an awful time with her, really. It isn't finished yet, either. It's an awful story.
Now, how did you get involved again in the current women's movement?
Well, some woman came out, and I don't remember her name, from Pittsburgh, to start the women's movement, and spoke in a hall on the college campus.
Where was that?
In Claremont, and at that meeting was not Tony Carabella, but Muley. What do you call
it? Judy Muley.
Muley. And I began talking to her about my classes and everything, and she got very excited about it and went back and reported it. And they got in touch with me and asked me if I'd give them a class. And, of course, they didn't have any money. So I said, well, I won't give a class unless people pay for it, because otherwise they'll come and they won't finish it. But I said, I'll give the money back to you to start your speaker's bureau. And so they had that class at the home of a woman whose name, I wonder where I've got her name, because she dropped out later. She got a divorce from her husband about that time, but she had a beautiful home up in Hollywood.
When was this, Jesse?
That was 1970.
Was that after that celebration of which you spoke, or
yeah,
before that?
It was okay. After that,
well,
1970.
How did you get involved before that? Then,
none at all. Muley went back and reported this meeting here where this woman spoke, and at the end of the meeting I said, well, you must have some classes in public speaking to develop your leaders. And she said, oh my goodness, we ought to do it right away. And she went back and stirred them up, and I think there were 20 or 25.
Mm-hmm.
Stapleton was in it, and Virginia Carter was in it, and I've got the list of all those people.
Well, how did you happen to go to the August 26th big celebration in 1970?
Well, then when that came off, of course, they were looking for some woman to, and they wanted to know if I had a speech on that, and I said, yes, I do, about Tennessee. And so they asked me to come in. I've never gotten any money for any of that, of course. All the work you do for them is they don't believe in volunteer work except for them.
Well, how did you happen to go to that very first meeting in Claremont there where you met Neely? Do you remember how you happened to go there?
Well, we just heard this woman was going to come out and talk about women, and Janelle Baker tipped me off on it. And so I just went, and we didn't like her talk at all. I don't know, it was an awful, messy talk. You bet I did.
When it came out?
Yes, sir. I read that book as soon as it came out. I think that's one reason I got to that meeting. I read that book as soon as it came out, and I had a great experience with one of my women in Washington named Dees Helb. Her name was Madam Dees Helb Adam. She was the wife of a diplomat from Holland, and she had gone back to Germany after she married. She had gone back to Holland and become a lawyer, gone through the whole law school, and then she wasn't satisfied with that most brilliant woman, one of the most brilliant women I ever knew in all my life. So then she went down to Switzerland and went through a whole course with the great psychoanalyst, not Freud, but the other one, Jung. Yeah. She studied with Jung for 2 or 3 years, and therefore became really a gifted practitioner of psychoanalysis at a time when it was still very new and undeveloped. And now she's in Washington, D.C., with her husband, who is a diplomat at the Dutch Embassy, when I run into her and tell her about this class. And she says, "Why, Mrs. Butler, I'm not interested in anything like that." She said, "I've been speaking all my life." And I said, "Yes, I know a lot of people have, but there is a technique to it that's different, just like there is in everything else. And all I ask is come once." Well, sir, she came once, and she took that class twice and turned into one of the most polished, beautiful speakers I ever heard. And then they were transformed to India. And as soon as she got down to India, the Indian government heard she'd had this course in public speaking, and they asked her to conduct classes down there for the top officials in the Indian government. I'm pretty sure that Indira Gandhi was in one of her classes. And all the time she was in India, she was teaching public speaking. She wrote back to me for my outline of my agenda. And I remember I spent a solid week writing out in detail, day by day, for 8 lessons, what I taught in each day. I never heard another word from her after that, but so I didn't know what she was doing, but later I found that she had been teaching all the top people in the Indian government, men and women, and gifted teacher. Well, then they went to several small countries around there, and she finally ended up in South Africa, where he was now, he also in India, he was now the head of the Dutch government, the ambassador in Holland, in India, and now he was the ambassador down in South Africa. When I got Betty Friedan's book and sent it to her, and by Jove, not only did she teach classes in speech down there, but she lectured all over South Africa on Betty Friedan's book. She said she had never read anything like it. It just fired her up. Then he died suddenly. Had a heart attack, had something happen to his head and died. She went back up to Holland and began teaching the Dutch officials. She was in The Hague, the top officials in Holland, public speaking, and talking about Betty Friedan's book all the time. When the leading newspaper woman, the leading newspaper in The Hague that had columns for women, ordered her to come back to America and do a tour of America on the American women and what they were doing. And so, by Jove, she came back over here and came clear out here to see me and get from me the latest word, and then she hunted up Betty Friedan. Well, that killed the book. Betty Friedan. I don't know if you know how much you know about Betty Friedan, but she's a very temperamental, very odd, very unusual, difficult woman to deal with, and she was so disillusioned by her that she just never wanted to see her again. I think Betty Friedan didn't think she was very important, and Betty Friedan doesn't spend much time courting anybody anyway. She was very disappointed. But anyway, she went all over America, studied the American women and what they were doing, and went back to Holland and reported them in this newspaper. So that that's the story of what happened to Betty Friedan's book when I got my hands on it. So all through those years, although I wasn't teaching or anything, I was reading everything I could get my fingers on that had to do with the woman's movement. And I consider Betty Friedan's book the greatest book I ever read. And when the history of this era is over, that book is the thing that's going to stand out as the leading book of this era, above everything else that's been written. I'm just as sure of that as anything. Now, a lot of people don't agree with that. But she's got the facts there, the whole woman's movement, and what needs to be done about it. And there's never been written such a book. I don't know how she ever wrote it. I've even heard people pretend that somebody else had written it because they couldn't believe that Betty Friedan, as she is now, was capable of writing such a book as that. Well, I don't care who wrote it or where it came from. In the ages ahead of us, we'll look back in this era, and that's the book that's changed the history of the world for women in this era. I know that's so.
Now, did you immediately become involved then, or it wasn't until that meeting?
As soon as I could, I did. Yeah. And I joined immediately after they had that caucus in Washington, D.C., that first caucus. I joined the national organization at once. I belonged to it ever since.
So when was that that you
did? I sent them $50, in fact. The minute that caucus had started, the National Organization for Women, I was so excited.
In 1966, then?
No, I didn't ever get back there, but I did send them $50 at once, and I'd have sent more if I'd had it, because I knew that they had started something that was perfectly tremendous, and the more I know about it, the more there's got to be done, because I've just been 2 whole days in Washington at that annual meeting of the Status of Women Commission for the state of California, and I never heard such brilliant speeches or such brilliant presentations of the issues that involve women in this state as I heard at that convention. It was marvelous, beautifully handled, brilliant speaking, and you know I'm very particular. They didn't all enunciate quite loud enough, so it was sometimes hard to hear them. But those women brought facts and material, well substantiated, and presented their causes and told that Status of Women Commission what they must do for their particular cause. And it was a great hearing, those 2 days' hearing. And we're facing, it's a revolution. There's no doubt about it. We're in for a revolution. And since it took 72 years just to get the vote, you can figure out for yourself how long it's going to take to solve this revolution that involves every part of women's lives.
Now, how do you see the revolution, Jesse?
Well, for one thing, my criticism, the 2 things I think have got to be done. One, women have got to learn to work together better. Now, do you know why they don't work together? And this is, I'm going to write an article on this if I get time. And the reason is that since the beginning of this eternity, women have been in competition for the same thing, which is married life and security. So they have formed an ego of competition. That every woman they meet is an antagonist. It's a terrible situation. And I know exactly how to correct it. It's got to be done. I've got it all worked out. But I don't want to tell you here, because this is going to be my next program, is to work on this. Another thing, the women have got to learn to run better homes. The reason why men are cashing out on the homes, our homes are chaotic. No Englishman would stay in a home like the American home is, because it's badly organized. There's a theory that the woman must do everything, bear all the children, do all the cooking, cleaning and everything, and it's a crazy performance. The British have licked that tooth. They're 2,000 years old and we're 200 years old. So I found out from the British how to answer that. We've got to have better run homes. And third, we've got to have mothers' clinics to teach women how to bear children and take care of children. England has made a science of childcare. Our girls are marrying ignorant, utterly ignorant of anything about having children, bringing up children, and caring for them. And we've got to set up a nationwide program on the subject of the care of little children. This is a terrible country for a little child to be born in. They don't have a gambler's chance of growing into normal human beings, and they aren't growing into normal human beings. Last year, 10,000 damaged children were brought into hospitals, nearly dead, but damaged by their parents, and not in the poverty area either. Cultured people, not trained to handle children, don't know how to handle them. And another 10,000 died in their cribs, in crib deaths, because they're not being breastfed. Cow's milk is not the milk for little children, and it chokes them to death the first 3 months. We got to do something about that, too.
Well, Jesse, what do you see as the goals for women? What do you think that should happen? What kind of changes do you
I need? Don't think the women yet know what their goals are. They're unhappy. They're getting divorces on the slightest excuse, running out of their homes. They're so unhappy, untrained, unequal to meeting the problems that they've got. They haven't made their goals yet. And the first thing we've got to do, I think, is to help the girls. Now, I've been in a high school all day today, the biggest high school in Ontario, Chaffey High. The beautiful young people there, just beautiful. But they haven't the faintest idea of how to make plans for their lives, to get a goal for their lives, and how to work it out. And they think to solve everything is quick run away from home and get married. Get out from the homes where they're unhappy and get married. Well, nothing could be worse. Marriage is a terribly difficult prospect, terribly difficult job. There's no more difficult job in the world than to make a marriage go, and the most worthwhile job. Nothing else will bring as much comfort and satisfaction as a good marriage. But it's got to be worked at. And these girls get married. This young man I've just been talking to is going to get married next month. He's no more fit for a marriage than a jackrabbit, nor is the girl who just wants to get away from home. What does she know? He hasn't even found his job. He hasn't found his skill. He doesn't know how he's going to earn a living. He doesn't like what he's doing now. He hasn't found himself. Neither has the girl found herself. How could you make a marriage success? And they aren't making it a success. They're getting divorces all over the place. They're failures. And then a lot of girls are so eager to get married that they quit school and earn the living while the man gets his education. And you know what happens? Half of them leave them the minute they get their education. One family that I know very well, I went to their wedding. And she stopped school in the middle, stopped her education, so as to finance the boy to finish his. The day he got his degree, he walked in and said, "Thank you very much. Goodbye. I'm glad to have known you." That's going on all over this country, these girls stopping their educations to carry on the boys till they get educated. Crazy idea. We haven't got ourselves any plan, any program, any vision, any issue, or any way of working out our lives. And so who's suffering? The little babies that come into these messy homes, badly run, badly planned. What chance have those babies got to ever grow up into normal citizens, to be useful to this country? So we've just got to, all these things have got to be straightened out, or our country is doomed. 50% of the marriages right now are falling on the rocks. Our country, any country that whose family life deteriorate is doomed. You cannot bring up citizens and people in family lives that are failures. How can you do such a thing? All these girls that go to welfare to get money when the men leave them, and the men leave them because they're so unhappy in their awful homes.
Now, Jesse, what differences do you see between the women's movement now and the women's movement at the beginning of the century?
Well, the women's movement, the whole women's movement is utterly carried on by untrained, unskilled women. And they're just trying to find themselves. Now, this consciousness group I haven't gone to any of these consciousness meetings, but the MS magazine this month describes a consciousness meeting the men are having, and they're finding it. The men are having to begin to find themselves. They, too, are in terrible trouble, just as much trouble as the women are. We're all in trouble in this country. 200 years. What's 200 years to learn to live in a country that built itself up in just 200 years from the Atlantic to the Pacific? And our roads, our houses, our schools, our buildings and everything have been miraculous. But that isn't enough to make life, the human side of life, right. And now we've got to get into the Aquarian age, which is the age of humanity. And the women have got to be freed to help us in that age, because they do. They are humane, women are, but though untrained. And so I see the work of the National Organization for Women. I want to help them all I can. But they're still very amateurish, very ill-advised, and it's going to take a long time to work out these issues.
Well, do you think that the earlier women's movement had a better sense of its own direction than the current?
No, no. Oh, no. I think they're finding their direction. Oh, no. They're making headway every day. Heidi's last letter before she went off to this annual meeting is a masterpiece, but she has nothing in it about the things I'm talking to you about babies and homes and mothers and training people for home life and family. That's nothing in there. All she's talking about is getting the better jobs for the better women. And now we know that the figures are that within 6 years, all but 8% of the women who get annuities from their husbands when they die are bankrupt. Bankrupt. Why? Because women don't know how to handle money. They've never been trained. A woman's husband dies in middle life, as many do. Many men die in middle life. Leaves her $100,000. Well, at 5%, that narrows down to about $400 a month. How can you, supposing she's got a lot of children, how can she educate and run a home at $400 a month? And so what does she do? $100,000. $100,000, she feels rich. So Aunt Mary needs help, and Uncle Joe needs help, and she's generous. And all but 8% are bankrupt. All but 6% are bankrupt within 8 years. And then what happens to them? They go to welfare. Bankrupt. We had one lecture at this commission, Status of Women Commission, of educated college women going to the welfare, starving to death because they've lost all their money that they got that they got in their annuities. They don't know how to handle money. One woman that I know of in this area, husband was sick a long time. It was obvious he was going to die. He finally did die. He left a great deal of money. She'd never even written a check. How's a woman like that going to know how to hang on to her money for the rest of her life? So she'll have something to eat. She won't know how to do it. She won't know how to think it out. So I think that gradually, issue after as issue is going to come up, and different women will arise who have leadership abilities and skill in that issue, as they did at this commission hearings.
Now, how do you think that the current women's movement compares to the suffrage struggle?
It isn't comparable in any respect. The suffrage just had one thing to do, to get women educated and men educated to go out and give women the right to vote. But that had anything like the depth of all these issues. They didn't go into these deep issues of their family lives, their homes, their children, and all that. They just said, we want to vote. We want to get good people in government. We have a right to vote because we're citizens. It was a simple little story, and took them 72 years to get that over. So what do you think you're going to get over these deep discussions, deep issues that we're in the midst of now? It is a revolution. And the men need it. The men are in just as bad shape as we are. They're beginning to see that in their consciousness meetings. These men are beginning to start in talking, as they always have, about their jobs and superficial things. Now they're beginning to get down to brass tacks about themselves. And they're saying, we hate to admit it, but we're learning something from the women on this. So I think the men and women together are going to join hands and work together to work this thing out. And we can't do it without the men to help us. and they'll want to help us. There are a lot of fine men, even in the Congress of the United States. Look at the two tough men I had to deal with, Congressman Ben Johnson and Reed Smoot, two of the toughest men in the United States Congress, and yet both of them helped me get that bill through once they saw the issue. We've got to have the help of the men along with the women. We can't do it without their help. And once you make them see the issue, why, even to get Woodrow Wilson to understand woman suffrage took 4 or 5 years. And then in the end, what did he do? When they finally got it, he wrote him a letter and said it was the finest thing he'd done since he'd been in the White House. So you can get at the men. You've got to get at them and make them understand where this issue is. Man can't be a success without a nice home and family.
Now, how do you think that we can begin to reach the women? I mean, all the women who really aren't involved in the women's movement, how do you think they could be reached?
I don't think we're going to reach the women except the ones that are unhappy. And there are plenty of them, and they're getting more and more. The women's club here in Claremont, where I belong, oh, they're just as smooth and happy. They don't want to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment. They don't even know what it is. Yeah, but one by one, every now and then, is suddenly getting a job. Because the only thing that keeps you from that welfare is one little man there. When he dies, then where are you going to go? See? Well, then they find out. So gradually, there'll be more and more of them begin to wake up to what's going on. And then all of a sudden, they'll come to some of these meetings and hear about the rest of us that have had a lot of trouble. See? I'm in a neat position because I had a howling career, a gorgeous education, before ever I got married. And then I had married an amazing man and in an amazing career, and I had an amazing career. So I went right on developing myself as a writer, a teacher, and a speaker, and then as a mother and a housekeeper. And I got away with it. I was in an environment where I got training to carry on all those things. So I've been blessed. I've had a long and complete and successful life doing everything I wanted to do and got away with it.
Now, Jesse, you're one of the few women of your, well, not even of your age, of 60 even, who is involved in the women's movement. How do the younger women in now, for instance, relate to you?
Well, I've just been all day with one of them, the perfectly darling girl. And she was having an awful fight with her father, and next month she had decided to move out of her home and go and live with a boy that she hardly knows at all, but just have what she calls a, what do we call this, Grecian friend, platonic friendship, see. And I've been all day with her. Well, sir, I've got her so excited about me and my life. And now I went over there with her to that high school, and she's got tremendous status in that school. And she's a very bright and talented girl. She's talking about going to try to get into the human engineering laboratory and find out whether she wants to be an architect and she wants to be a musician. She's a talented musician, but now she's gone into the drafting class against the advice of her counselor. What do you want to learn drafting for? He said, I'm against it. Well, I said to her, I know why you need to learn drafting, and she said, why? And I said, we've got to have a lot of women architects to reorganize the building of the houses that are going on all wrong. And there are very few women architects. So if drafting is something you can do, you could grow into an architect, and then you could have your music as your outside interest. Well, she hasn't decided yet. But anyway, I don't think she's going to get out of, I said, a brilliant girl like you with this record in this school, you hang on to that home till you get educated. And you'll be the sweetest, loveliest child in that home you ever saw. So nobody can make you mad. Do everything they ask you to do.
Now she's involved in the Now chapter that you're in?
Yes, she is. She's been helping them write those releases, and she helps them send them out. And so it just shows. She thinks I'm great, and she can't.
So you're really accepted by the other women in
the world? Oh, yeah. They're beginning now. It took them a long time. At first, they thought I was a farce, that I was just putting on a show, and I had nothing real at all. And Valerie Elliott told me she's going to preside for me Thursday night, and she said they all thought that I was just a make-believe, and I was just trying to convince somebody I was something when I wasn't. They're beginning to see that that isn't so. And so gradually, slowly, I'm digging into them. I've got something to share with them, I'm telling you. I did want to add one more thing, and that is that in a strange way, from the time I've been a little girl, I wanted to help women. And I really have done it. When I worked 4 years in Massachusetts with that Massachusetts Minimum Wage Commission, I had to go out and copy prey rolls in candy factories, brush factories, horrible places. And that was to help women, to find out what was going on with women that were being exploited like that. And I just love women. I love working with them. I've loved teaching them. I know how to teach them. And I can forget the fact that I'm critical with women. I see the wealth in those women, the virtue, the character, the goodness.